It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Cynthia Schuster in for Rob Farid. You're with us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, from inches to miles, we'll look at the unique origins of American measurement systems and why the USA never went metric despite a big push in the 1970s.
First, in the aftermath of the shooting of 18-year-old Michael Brown in Ferguson, Missouri, there's been considerable outrage directed at the officer implicated in the shooting. For our next guest, the story hits close to home. 10 years ago, Michael Bell's 21-year-old son was shot and killed outside of his home in Kenosha.
Since then, Bell has pushed for Wisconsin to pass a law requiring an outside agency to conduct investigations in police-related deaths, a law that ultimately passed in the last legislative session. He says our country is simply not paying enough attention to the lack of accountability in police departments and the way it affects all of us, regardless of race or ethnicity.
Michael Bell joins us now. He's a retired lieutenant colonel in the U.S. Air Force and just wrote a piece for Politico magazine called What I Did After Police Killed My Son. Michael, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me on your show.
Well, as you watch the story unfold in Ferguson after the police shooting of teenager Michael Brown, what's going through your mind?
Well, a lot of things have gone through my mind. I know what the family feels like, and being a retired Air Force officer, I in many ways feel I know what the law enforcement people must be going through. It's very hectic. For the family, though, they're going through some very tragic moments. The best way I can describe it is it felt like a car fell on me. I mean, to get a phone call that your son is shot. I was upset, too, when they released the autopsy photos, or not photos, but drawings, because I did notice that one or two of the shots were in the head. And in my own son's case, an officer took a gun and placed it directly to my son's head and shot him in front of his mother and sister. And very, very tragic for our whole family. So I carried all those emotions with me when I watched the mom on TV over the last day or two.
Hmm. And it's been 10 years since your son was shot and killed, but it still sounds like it's fresh to you.
Well, you know, we've been fighting for this for a long time, and our family has done a lot of work with counselors and so forth. But you can't fight this effort and do the things that we did by changing laws and so forth without keeping that wound a little bit open.
You've written that there's good reason to think that, quote, many of these unjustifiable homicides by police across the country are racially motivated, but there's a lot more going on here. What's the big picture as you see it?
Well, you know, as an Air Force officer, as a professional, I couldn't come out in the community until I looked at all the different problems that were out there in the nation. And we took a look at all the civilian review boards and so forth, and I brought in a researcher, and I go, how many shootings are really going on? And when we started looking at things, we could not find, since 1885, an unjustified ruling by a police and fire commission, an inquest, or a police department related to any fatal shooting in the state of Wisconsin, 129 years. And in 2005, we found that there was a shooting in Milwaukee. The department ruled it justified. An inquest jury ruled it justified, but additional information was brought in by citizens, and the DA ended up charging the person. So to me, the problem is a culture issue where accountability is at stake.
What happened to your son, Michael?
My son came home from a night out with friends. To make a long story short, he pulled up in front of his house. An officer met him there. The officers made some false accusations. My son was like, no way, I didn't, you know, do that. The officer tased my son. My son started receiving some physical confrontations. My son ran to the back. He confronted the officer back. And then Michael's mother and his sister came out. They heard commotion. My son was bent over a car. An officer was holding him, and an officer came up and placed a gun to my son's head and fired a fatal shot in front of his mother and sister. We ended up having to hire an investigator, and our investigator uncovered that an officer who claimed that my son had his gun had actually hooked his gun on a broken car mirror. The police department had conducted a review. They had cleared themselves in as soon as 48 hours, and they hadn't even talked to some of the witnesses that were there. There were five eyewitnesses. It was under a large floodlight in a garage, And that's why I said that if a blonde-haired, blue-eyed boy can be shot under a spotlight with five eyewitnesses, and his father is a retired Air Force lieutenant colonel who flew three wars for his country, and we cannot get accountability, then Joe the plumber and Javier the roofer are going to have the same problem that we've had.
Well, you write that it took 6 years to get your wrongful death lawsuit settled. Your family eventually received $1.75 million, and you put that back into police accountability to advocate for that. How did you go about doing that?
Well, the first thing I did is we took out additional advertising in the beginning. We wanted to call out what was going on in Kenosha. And in the beginning, district attorney was running for judge. And if you actually go to the michaelbell.info website, you can see there's a link there that says that this district attorney was being endorsed by every police agency in the county as he was actually reviewing another police-related shooting. And so after he lost his election, he decided to honor the police officers with meritorious service awards. So we ended up taking out ads in the Sun-Times, Chicago Sun-Times, New York Times, and so forth. But when the settlement occurred, we refused to accept a non-disclosure. It was always my intent to tell Michael's story, and I wasn't going to be paid off with a paltry sum of money like that, and because a lot of it went to the attorney, and not be able to share my son's story. So I refused a non-disclosure. The mayor of the city of Kenosha allowed that to happen, and therefore our documents weren't sealed. We ended up using those funds to take out billboards, TV ads, and so forth, and we helped a number of other families who have lost loved ones in the state of Wisconsin. You have to remember that this is just not a Michael Bell effort or a Michael Bell family effort. This is a team. We have fantastic individuals who have been creative, and our whole team has never once thrown a Molotov cocktail. We actually got it done with kindness and respect and good creativity and hard work.
Now, you write that initially, after your son was killed, you told your wife and your daughter to be patient, that investigations took a while to unfold. But eventually you realized that this investigation was not going to be anything that had the kind of integrity you were looking for. You dug deeper. You discovered a problem statewide in Wisconsin where an officer had never been found culpable in years and years, decades and decades. Is this just a problem in Wisconsin? How widespread do you think this is?
I think it's widespread. I think it happens across the nation. And some of the hot spots, Eugene, Oregon, Chandler, Arizona, San Diego, California, those people have actually got to the point where they actually do bring in outside investigators. But Wisconsin is the first one that ever mandated all police-involved shootings in the state of Wisconsin or deaths be reviewed by an outside agency. The biggest reason I urge caution was because of the fact that I, as an Air Force officer, knew how mishap investigations were conducted. Typically, a weapon system was lost, lives were lost, and the United States Air Force brought in an investigative team to look at every detail and say, what really happened here and what could we do to make sure that this doesn't happen again? And that's why I thought if the police agencies reviewed each death like that, then police-related deaths would be on an all-time low.
Well, as you said, you did succeed in your quest, at least here in Wisconsin. We're the first state to pass a law requiring an outside agency to investigate deaths in police custody. Is it enough for you? How far do you want to take this?
Well, originally our bill asked for three parts. A lot of things that are happening out there, nobody has a solution. We have a solution. Our bill had three parts. Make sure that the police officer who has the right to take a life was in a clear frame of mind to either pull the trigger or wield the baton. Make sure that they weren't under the influence of alcohol or some type of painkiller or something like that, because that's what happens in a cockpit and that's what happens in a trucking accident. The second thing we asked for was an outside investigation. A police department should not review itself and clear itself of wrongdoing. Bring in outside professionals, allow them to look at it and let them make a determination, because the data can be corrupted when the department conducts its own investigation. And the last thing that we asked for was an independent review of that by law professionals, not just law enforcement. Take the finest people out there, retired judges, retired DA, criminal justice professors, and law enforcement, put them on a panel and allow them to look at it and make sure that this shooting was valid. And if it wasn't, what can we do to make sure that it doesn't happen again? That's what it needs to go. And that's what we tried to do in Wisconsin. We only got part two. And we're going to go back for parts one and three later on. But I think that if what was going on in Missouri had been under this outside investigation, the distrust that is occurring with law enforcement right now would not occur, and therefore the riots may not be happening.
So is your wish then that this legislation in all parts, not just the first two, but everything you outline there, be a blueprint for the rest of the country?
If you go into the article that I wrote in Politico, and if you go there, we actually have the national ad that we took out in USA Today. And right down in the bottom it says, this can be a national model. Wisconsin could be a national model for the rest of the nation.
Now that you've got the spotlight right now, people are turning to you. You've got this perspective based on what your own family has been through. What is the message you want to send to the American public right now?
Number one, be patient with Ferguson, okay? Like military members, law enforcement are many times our heroes. And I'm telling you right now, we just went through the second anniversary of the Sikh shooting in Oak Creek, and Lieutenant Murphy took a number of bullets for people. You can go back up to Green Bay where a state trooper named Les Bolt got out of his car, sprinted up, and grabbed a woman who was jumping off a bridge to commit suicide. They're many times our hero, okay? But right now, be patient with Ferguson. Allow the facts to happen. But we do wonder that if there wasn't a national attention on this, what would have occurred? Would there have been a truthful investigation down in Ferguson if the national attention wasn't there? That's the message we'd like to send out.
Michael, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you very much for having me. Take care.
Michael Bell is a retired lieutenant colonel in the U.S. Air Force. We've got a link to his piece, What I Did After Police Killed My Son, on the Central Time Facebook page.
Well, ask anyone who has recently moved to the United States, and they'll tell you, our systems of measurement don't seem to make any sense. After all, why are we bothering with inches and feet when centimeters and meters seem to work just fine everywhere else?
But how did we get to this point in the first place? Our next guest took a closer look at the origins of various measurement systems to see how they evolved.
Joining us now is John Bemelmans Marciano. He's an author and illustrator, and his new book is Whatever Happened to the Metric System, How America Kept Its Feet. John, welcome to Central Time.
Oh, thanks for having me on.
Well, from an outsider's perspective, our measurement system in the United States might seem bizarre. For us, though, for us who have grown up here in the United States, they just seem to click. Why did the U.S. end up with its own set of measurements while most of the world went with the metric system?
Well, it's really a question of, basically everybody else in the world had a system of measurement, originally extremely similar to ours. The change really started happening around the time, shortly after our revolution, when we adopted the U.S. dollar, which amazingly was the first truly decimal system of measurement that was ever created and used by a nation. It was devised mostly by Thomas Jefferson, and he actually had a plan for taking our measures to be all across the board completely decimal. At that time, though, this was the time of the French Revolution, there was invented the metric system, and Jefferson actually wanted America to consider what they were taking up.
Mm-hmm. Well, tell us more about that. For a while, it seemed we were poised to adopt it, and then it never came to pass. What took us off the rails?
Well, we had actually flirted with the metric system pretty heavily. I mean, even George Washington had kept asking the Congress to look at it, but it disappeared from Europe and only really started to make any headway anywhere in around the 1840s. America looked at it then and pretty steadily looked at it right up until the First World War. Then it utterly disappeared from the American consciousness and kind of reared its head again in the 1860s. I'm sorry, in the 1960s. In 1975, Gerald Ford passed the Metric Act that was supposed to take us metric, and there was a huge push to do so, but it just never took.
Mm-hmm. Were there ever any sort of geopolitical reasons for that? And you mentioned that it was on our minds up until about World War One or something. Was there any reason that we would want to, for example, distance ourselves from the European way?
Well, the metric system was kind of sweeping the world in the first part of the 20th century. And then with the onset of the Great Depression, kind of all nations retreated into into nationalism. Internationalism was on the downswing. So places like Japan that were converting to metric actually abandoned the program. When it really took hold worldwide was in the 1950s. Most of the English-speaking world was on either the customary system of measures, which is what we use, or on the British imperial system. The real push for us actually came when the British decided to adopt the metric system, which they had really resisted, but it actually became a condition of their joining the European community.
Talk a bit about the origins of the metric system itself and how, centimeters and millimeters and those units became really the core of the system itself.
Well, the idea was actually that the world, the circumference of the Earth, one meridian, was divided into 40 million parts, and that 40 millionth part of the Earth was 1 meter. And then essentially everything else was slotted in decimally. So a hundredth was centimeter and a millimeter and so on. So it was this idea of connecting the measurement system to the Earth. One cubic decimeter of water was the kilogram, and the liter was also connected. So it was this idea of this really comprehensive system of measurement.
And you had mentioned earlier Thomas Jefferson's role in developing our current currency and everything. Draw the link for us, though, between the metric system itself and dollars and cents.
Well, it was this idea that had come up during the Enlightenment, during the middle of the 17th century, where decimal. I mean, it seems almost impossible for us to imagine, but the decimal point was only decimal fractions. The decimal point was only invented in the 16th century, and it really didn't catch on at all until the 17th century. And even at that time, it was only used by the elite of the elites. It was really only around the time of the Revolution that it became right up there with literacy. So decimal fractions was a really new idea. If you think about it, they're actually very artificial creation. I mean, if you imagine trying to cut a pizza into 10 pieces, it's pretty hard. If you wanted to, for instance, one of the most typical things that a person would do when they were shopping would be to buy cloth. So if you wanted to buy a small portion of cloth, you would buy something like an eighth of a yard. And the way this would be measured out would be they would fold the yard of cloth into halves, into quarters, and then into eighths, and they would cut it from there. When the metric system was first introduced, that eighth of a yard became 0.125 meters, which was one-tenth plus two-hundredths plus five-thousandths. It was an almost incomprehensible amount of math for people who were really not used to, forget about decimal points, they weren't even really used to multiplication or division. So it was really only when people started getting decent math skills in the middle of the 19th century that something like the metric system was even possible.
Mm-hmm. And we also differ from the world, we in America, with temperatures. And while the rest of the world is measuring the temperature in Celsius, we're in degrees Fahrenheit. How do we end up with the Fahrenheit system?
Well, this is one of the most interesting ones for me, because where you can make an argument that there's a lot more sense in dividing, the meter into hundredths and thousandths than it is dividing the yard and the foot into, the yard into thirds and the foot into twelfths. Both scales are actually decimal. I mean, 100 degrees is 100 degrees no matter, which scale you use. The fact of the matter is that the Celsius scale, whatever you choose for the temperature of freezing water or boiling water, is actually quite arbitrary. There's nothing that says a temperature scale needs to be based on that. What the Fahrenheit scale's weakness is actually that it has negative numbers. It really plays havoc with doing any sort of calculations, scientific calculations. Mm-hmm. And the Celsius scale really just made that problem worse. So even in the actually officially sanctioned measures of science, the SI system of measurement, Celsius is only a secondary measure. The real scale that scientists use is Kelvin, which is based on absolute zero.
Right. Well, John, thank you so much for joining us today. We have so much more to delve into, but we'll have to check it out in your book. Thanks again.
All right. Thanks a lot.
John Bemelmans Marciano is an author and illustrator, and his new book is Whatever Happened to the Metric System, How America Kept Its Feet. We look at a new trend. A lot of young people save money by having roommates, but now older Americans are sharing homes with roommates too. One out of every three baby boomers is now single and approaching retirement. Now, some of them are returning to living with roommates to save some money, especially older women.
Here to talk about this new trend is Connie Skillingstad. She's the president of Golden Girl Homes Incorporated, a volunteer-based group that helps older people find roommates. Connie, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you. Good to be here.
So when we talk about older people here looking for roommates, who are we talking about? Who are these people?
Well, we're talking about, I think, more women than men, ages ranging from early 40s to probably healthy 80s. And they are people who, as you said, live alone and maybe don't want to.
What reasons do they have for not wanting to be alone?
Well, I think it's a combination of things. There's safety, there's economic reasons as people struggle to have enough money to retire. There's certainly social and emotional needs, the need for community, the need for friendship, the need for just a shared life.
Now, if you're talking about people in their 20s, say, who are looking for roommates, they're going to go on Craigslist, find someone hopefully compatible, and go from there. But how is it different when you're in your golden years?
Well, it's interesting. I had talked to a woman recently and a reporter asked her why she didn't go on Craigslist. And she just said it had to do with her concern for safety, concern for confidentiality, and the need for someone to sort of help her through the process. So it's really an opportunity to meet people who are more like you, and you can be maybe a little more selective.
And what about computer literacy? Is that something that ever comes into play?
Well, we do operate with a website and emails and that type of thing, and so there's some degree of computer literacy, but we have many older people who don't use computers, so for us, it's really important to also have hard copies of things, hard copies of the newsletter, and opportunities for people to talk to us voice-to-voice by phone.
Can you tell us a story about one of the people you work with who used your service and is now living happily with a roommate in their golden years?
Sure. Actually, I can. Some of it's a little bit of a conglomerate, maybe, but there are women who have a home. Maybe have been through a divorce and or are widowed, and they have space in their home, children grown, and then they're looking at the economic issues that they're facing. We certainly have women involved with foreclosure who can't keep their homes, and they need that kind of help to do it. So what we do then is they get opportunities to use our website or in other ways through our gatherings, let people know what they have available, how much do they want to rent it for. And so we have women who have, I'll give you an example. We do an open house, and there's a gal who had a lovely home, and she had been renting to students and sort of decided that she didn't want to do that. She really wanted to have more of a community sense, someone that she could share her kitchen with and someone that could really be a friend. And so we did the open house. We had a number of our women come through and visit and talk about her lifestyle, and like right away, because of the rental, she charged like $350 for a really nice space. We rented it. She rented it right away, and they've become really good friends because they both garden. They're both very creative women with unique occupations. So they've been together now about 3 years, and it's going extremely well.
So is this something that is just particular to the city where you live, or is this a cultural shift that's taking place across all of the country?
I think it's very much a cultural shift. We're in the greater Twin Cities area in Minnesota, and we have a lot of interest, but we've gotten picked up in media by a variety of national news outlets, and so we have people who call us from actually all over the world, New Zealand and Canada and Great Britain and France, and where they're doing similar types of things. But here in the United States, we hear from women all over the country who either have space they want to rent, are looking to relocate after retirement, and they'd like to find someone with whom they were compatible to live with. And so we're hearing from every corner of the United States. We've also begun a national collaborative because there are other people around the country who are seeing that this is a really viable option, especially for older folks. And they are doing similar things to what we're doing. And so part of it is developing a national database where people can come on, can say, well, this is where I live, this is what I'm looking for, and can connect in that way as well. And the database we're using also does criminal background checks.
Uh-huh. So you do some of that legwork.
Yes.
Why do you suppose that it's mostly women who are using this? In fact, that the name of your company is Golden Girl Homes. Why yeah. Just women?
Well, we hear from men now and then, but I think it's partly economic. Women made less money. Women are less, actually many women are not able to retire, and they didn't work at jobs that paid a lot. They didn't work at jobs that had retirement programs and that type of thing, so their income is more limited. They get less Social Security usually because they were paid less, and it goes kind of on and on that women are in that situation. Plus, women live several years longer than men on average, and that means then that they're going to be healthier longer and have those needs for a longer period of time.
We hear from time to time that sometimes the older years of a person's life can be isolating, that they may lose contact with friends and children may move away. Is this part of the answer?
Oh, I think so. I think so. Women, actually, isolation is one of the key issues around depression in older folks, too. And this is an opportunity for them to build new friendships, to connect in new ways with people. We have the gatherings here in Minnesota where on a monthly basis people come together and hear speakers and talk about their experience of shared housing and all of the, and then build friendships through that process. And there's no question that as life goes on, we do lose friends, we do lose family members, and we need to replenish that.
How do you pair people together if you've got, you know, say a pool of people who are all looking for roommates? How do you make sure that the right ones end up together?
Well, for us, we don't see that as our role because we're talking about adults. We're talking about adults who can make up their own mind. And so what we want to do is make sure that there are opportunities for them to connect and then for them to make their own decisions about whether or not this is someone they could live with. So we help them through also finding and exploring who they are, what their needs are, what kind of people could they live with, what kind of people could they not. You know, are pets part of the picture, or smoking, or, you know, a whole variety of lifestyle questions. And so we help them through that so they can make some decisions about whether this is for them and also who might be a good match.
So walk us through this. Let's say I'm looking for a roommate. What is the process like?
Okay. Initially, people register and get into our database, and we then include them in a newsletter. We have a membership of $25 a year that then allows them to advertise for free and to connect to our gatherings. And if they're visiting, they may pay for a continental breakfast, but members come for free. And so in one way or another, they learn about who's got availability of property, who is looking for what sort of situation, and then they need to kind of come out and meet other women, because we're mostly women, meet other folks and kind of take it from there. We'll do at a meeting maybe something like a speed dating process where they learn about what kind of questions they want to ask, and then they get some chance to interview the women that are there so they can determine if even very quickly, we can have a pretty good idea whether we want to get to know somebody better.
Now, obviously, hearing you talk about this, what comes to mind is the TV show The Golden Girls. Obviously, it came to your mind, too. It's the name of your company.
Yes.
Is that how you see this? I mean, that was a lot of fun. There was Sophia and Dorothy and Blanche all living together and really still living their lives fully. Is that how you envision this?
That is the sort of vision that I have. It's that people are, generally, it's people who are independent. They may still be working. They have a career. They do volunteer work, or they like to travel or whatever, and that they live together, and they share a portion of their life, but they also maintain their independence, and they come and go as is appropriate for them. I think the difference might be that we do have women who own homes and have people rent because they couldn't afford to buy, and even the cost of apartments gets out of sight. But we also have women who come together to purchase a home together. So if you can't afford to buy a house by yourself, or you own a home and it's just getting to be too much, that you can do that together. Find women who are compatible and you can purchase, and then we go through a process with that, because there's legal issues, there's agreements and all the rest that need to be thought through.
We're talking right now with Connie Skillingstad of Golden Girl Homes Incorporated about the trend of older Americans, largely women in this case, sharing homes together.
And we want to hear from you on this as well. What do you think about the trend of older people living together as roommates? Is it a good idea or a bad idea? Let us know. You can call us at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. Are you a baby boomer with a roommate? You can also send an email with your story at talk@wpr.org.
We're picking up our discussion now with Connie Skillingstad of Golden Girl Homes Incorporated about older Americans sharing homes for economic and social benefits.
And we're taking your calls. What do you think about the trend of older people living together as roommates? Are you a baby boomer who's considered doing that yourself? Have you considered that in your life or for yourself or for a parent? Let us know at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. You can also send us an email at talk@wpr.org.
We go now to the phones and take our first call from Carol in Radisson. Hi, Carol.
Hi. Are you talking to me?
Yep, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Okay. I just wanted to make the comment that I've been saying this for years, that this is what was going to happen, not simply because of financial reasons, but there's not going to be enough nursing homes, and even if they built enough, there's not going to be enough young people to work in them to take care of all of us old people. We are going to have to move in together simply to be able to take care of each other.
All right. So you saw this coming, Carol. And Connie, what about that? Are you ahead of the curve on this one? You saw a need, and there's a big market out there for this.
Yeah, we started our work in 2000, but I think too that it's been coming for a long time, and it's really beginning now to pick up speed.
And what about Carol's statement that, you know, there's not going to be enough nursing homes or people to staff them?
Well, the other thing is that for many of us, I would agree with that, but for many of us, it's also not our wish to be in that situation. We really want to stay as independent as long as possible. And we'd rather be with people who we care about and who care about us.
Well, thank you so much for the call, Carol. And we're going to move next to Jane in Eau Claire. Hi, Jane.
Hi.
What do you think about this?
Well, I am a landlord, and we invest largely in single-family, nice quality single-family homes. And we have a hard time finding reliable, clean, good quality tenants. I really think there are a lot of landlords who would be interested in even developing or purchasing places that would be suitable for these types of tenants. They sound like the kind of tenants that we have a really good experience with. And I'm wondering if I just started listening to the show just now, and I'm wondering if she could put on a website or something where we could contact her organization and see if there's some way to make good quality, well taken care of rentals, kind of a list or something available to these folks.
All right. Well, thank you for that, Jane. And it's interesting, Jane, from the perspective of a landlord, saying this sounds like you're the kind of tenant that a lot of people would want. Would you like to speak to that and maybe also give the website?
Sure. It's exciting to hear because I agree with her. And we have heard from other landlords. We have visited some homes in the area here where the owner wants to rent to. This is a much more reliable in many ways group of people to be renters. They're likely to stay longer, that type of thing. And I'm very excited about the possibilities of that. We've also talked with realtors who are very interested in helping us locate homes that women could buy together that have the qualities we're looking for. The website for us is goldengirlhomes.us or .org.com. We picked up all of those. So it's www.goldengirlhomes.com
and org, it sounds like.
Com, U.S., and org.
Okay, great. Well, thank you for that, Jane. And Connie, when people get a little more advanced in age and they may have some health problems, are there ever situations where two roommates come together and maybe have some nursing care brought into the home and have that be part of what their experience is?
I've heard of some situations one where three women bought a fourplex, and in buying the fourplex, they each had a unit, and then they had the fourth unit that they only rented to nurses.
Oh. Well, so people are getting really creative.
And they rented it to nurses for less so that they could have access to some of that nursing care.
So people are really solving.
It is the type of thing that I think people can be as creative as they want to, but it also means you can hire some things done that you can't do for yourself anymore because you have a little bit more discretionary money. So you can hire your yard work done, or you can hire heavier cleaning or whatever it is that you need, and I think that makes a difference. As people live together longer, too, I think then building that relationship, then it becomes more palatable, so to speak, to take care of each other.
Let's go back to our phone lines. We've got Peter next in Madison. Hi, Peter.
Hello.
Hi, what do you think about this?
Well, my thunder's been stolen by everybody that has just spoken. I'm a home builder and designer, and I was designing a home that's a hybrid of a totally ADA accessible area with an additional area that would be semi-autonomous for somebody to come in, like a relative or a healthcare provider, to live in the home. Hello?
Yeah. Gotcha. Just making sure you were done, Peter. So Peter's talking about what you were alluding to as well, Connie, sort of a new hybrid of home, a new living model that it seems like a lot of people would like because of the increased independence that it gives them.
I've been hearing more about that type of thing happening in a variety of ways, and I think one of the things we are going to begin to see, because we have intergenerational families living together more and more children taking their parents in. My career was in the area of child abuse, and what I think is happening is that parents are doing a better job and their kids are liking their parents better than they used to and are more willing to live together. And I think we're going to see a variety of housing options coming out that are different, that have an extra living space. Or in the case of seniors, as we work with them, my hope is to see more homes with multiple master suites because people want their own bathroom. And so to build in a way that people can have their own bedroom, bathroom, closet space in a home where they share the other common spaces is one of my visions.
Do you have any plans to try to get men more involved in this? The stereotype, I don't know if you want to call it that, is that the women might tend to be more social as they get older. The men may be more isolated.
Yeah, and it is happening in some parts of the country. There are men who are doing this sort of thing, and they are developing relationships that have that possibility to them. Women are also open to the idea that men may live within their homes because men bring some different skills or some different different contribution to the situation. So women are not all averse to the idea that they may share with a man in a situation that isn't romantic. It's more out of friendship and necessity.
Connie, do you think this is a game changer, a new model for the older years that's a lot more hopeful than, you know, a retirement community or an assisted living? Is this sort of a second life?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Because many, many women that we talk to do not want to be in an all-senior situation. They want to live in a community. They want to be part of the community. And they don't want the isolation that sort of says, okay, now we're done with you, you know. And that isn't what it's about, nor should it be.
And do you have plans for taking Golden Girls to the next level?
Well, we're hopeful that we can get some investors or some grants to help us because we have been all volunteer, and it's growing beyond us. The National Collaborative is very exciting because we're working with women. They're pretty much women that have written books about how to do this. There's some great resources on our website and out there of books. So if you want to share housing, how do you do this? There's ones called My House, Our House. There's another one called, it's just about building your own community, in essence. And so there's things happening that will help all of us to do this.
Connie, thank you so much for joining us and talking about this trend.
Yes. Thank you so much for having me.
That was Connie Skillingstad, president of Golden Girl Homes Incorporated.